We've been reviewing the Satipatthana Sutta, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, for several weeks now. And we've gotten close to the culmination of the discourse, the seven awakening factors. The final element of the eightfold, I mean, of the Four Foundations of Mindfulness is a revisiting of the Noble Eightfold Path, the fulfillment of the Noble Eightfold Path. What I want to do is provide a review, an overview of the seven awakening factors and hone in on the first three. And I think that as I go through the process, it'll become more clear how that operates. So it's interesting. I've talked about the seven awakening factors many times over the decades that I've been teaching. So I was revising one of my earlier talks that I gave on a one-week retreat. But I started asking or making queries to ChatGPT, which I've been doing lately, just out of curiosity. But also, I find that a lot of what I'm picking up from my carefully posed queries is very interesting and stimulating. So today I stopped. Well, I finished reviewing the earlier talk. I revisited it and updated it today because I just had put in a query to the AI program about the awakening factors. And what came up really, really caught my attention. So I'm going to post the other Dharma talk, the other document, when I post the tonight talk. Well, and also the notes that I prepared is kind of a hybrid between ChatGPT and my own understanding. So I hope it's useful for you. The seven awakening factors basically are fundamental qualities of the mind, fundamental in a way that promotes awakening, liberation from craving and clinging. I often talk about this process of awakening as moving from what I call self-state conflict. I think we can all kind of identify with that, to self-state integration, which would be described as part personality structure, a way of feeling and acting in the world that was not particularly anxious or dull or preoccupied or disorganized. So that would be self-state integrity or integration. And that provides the platform for self-state liberation, the awakening process, the fulfillment of it. Seven awakening factors are basically wholesome qualities of mind that emerge as this integrative process matures. And it's a system. We talk about the seven factors, mindfulness, investigation of mental phenomenon, energy, joy, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. And they each have their kind of own singular characteristic, but they cannot operate without each other. It's an interdependent system. In fact, one of the major emphases think points of emphasis with in Buddhism is the interdependence between the mind, the body, and the world. And so, of course, within that, the awakening factors reach their fulfillment through coordination. And that's what's into in creates the integration and moves on to full liberation. There's so much that I could say about the awakening factors. To me, it's really, really fascinating. The seven awakening factors and the what's called paticca samuppada, dependent origination, are really, really interesting for me in terms of my understanding and my practice. What I'm going to do is talk about the seven awakening factors in a way that's kind of different. I've talked about this before, but it's different from the classical rendering. In terms of the seven awakening factors, they're basically organized into three clusters. There's an energizing cluster, which is investigation, joy, and concentration. And then there's the tranquilizing functions, which are, excuse me, I have that a bit wrong. Joy and concentration are activating functions, and energy, of course. And the tranquilizing and concentration and equanimity are all monitored by mindfulness. So that's a classic rendering. I think I may have misstated it a bit. But what I'm interested in is the application of the awakening factors. I said that they can, they have their own characteristics, but they operate, they cooperate. So as far as I'm concerned in my practice, the first three of the awakening factors, mindfulness, investigation of mental phenomena, and energy, set the stage for the other remaining factors. So I'm going to be talking about those three factors specifically tonight. And next week, I think Susan Baxter is going to be reviewing the joy and tranquility factors, which really address kind of the emotional aspect of life. And then the following week, I believe it's Leslie's turn, and she's going to review the concentration and equanimity factors, which are more about the quality of attention. Is attention either rigid or loose or in a balanced middle zone? So let me start to talk about the three factors more specifically. Mindfulness provides a stabilizing function. When I say it provides it, its ability to do that is requires the participation of investigation and the appropriate channeling of energy. But in terms of describing the characteristics, I have to kind of hone in on each one of them. Mindfulness is considered to be, well, first, let me say that the Pali word for mindfulness is sati. And sati is can be understood as not being absent-minded or non-forgetfulness. And in the time of the Buddha, Brahmanism was predominant, and sati pertained to the skill with which a Brahmin priest had to memorize and make manifest the rites and rituals that would appease the gods. So that kind of procedural monitoring is valuable. It's important. But the other part is that the Buddha repurposed this term, that instead of it being about being able to repeat a particular kind of routine with great accuracy, what it really means is to not be operating through an internal processing system that was or is misrepresenting or misperceiving what's going on. Don't forget that. Remember to put into play the principles and practices of the Four Noble Truths. So mindfulness in this regard basically means noticing how the system of selfing is operating, monitoring it in a metacognitive way, a kind of hovering over. One of the similes that's used is that of the chief minister of a king. This is classic Buddhism. And the chief minister's role involves monitoring the functions of the different bureaucracies of the kingdom, the money management, defense, civil issues, and so forth and so on. So mindfulness would, sati would be monitoring this and then reporting to the king, which is the process of awakening in this case. So that's part of it. So it's a contextual awareness. And that's the thing I want to emphasize about this whole process of the Buddha's Dharma, is we spend our lives being preoccupied with content. Particular sound comes up. It's just part of the ambient world. All these other things are going on, but that sound somehow or other becomes a self. The mind's representation of that sound, reaction to it. So that process, when it's not skillfully attended to, basically we go down the rabbit hole, so to speak. We go into a world that is being fabricated based on misunderstanding and emotional impulse, right? So we want to be able to observe that process rather than be fixated on the content. The content being the sound and what the mind makes of it. That seems to be what hooks us. But what we want to do with mindfulness is to remember a certain kind of procedural approach to this. And this involves, first of all, remembering or being aware of the intention to cultivate the process of awakening. To recognize when the mind wanders away from that primary task, noticing how the quality of attention and the level of agitation or tranquility in the selfing process is operating. Noticing how that's changing. Attention becomes more acute or more diffuse. There's a feeling of urgency because of, I don't know, an achy knee, or a feeling of tranquility because the mind is settled and calm. Being able to monitor that and do this in an ongoing way. When this is not operating, this mindfulness isn't operating effectively, it's cooperation with the second factor, investigation of mental phenomena, is disabled, so to speak. Instead of there being some kind of active observing, knowing of what's going on in the mind, there's a sort of a internal commentary about it. And this becomes overwhelming, so to speak. That's what craving and clinging is about. So instead of there being a smooth flow of energy, the third awakening factor, it becomes, or it manifests as agitation. So that's important to keep in mind, literally, in terms of sati, that there's this capacity for what's called metacognitive awareness in psychological terms. There's a kind of operationally, there's an observing self, and there is that which is observed. Now, ultimately, Buddhism wants to be able to drop the observing self function and there just be whatever's happening without any kind of self-defense or self aggrandizing going on. So mindfulness is the condition that allows an awakening process to become visible and trainable. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about this kind of procedurally, just kind of describing the characteristics of each of these first. Second one is investigation of mental phenomena, Dhammavicaya. And it's a discerning kind of process. Mindfulness is being aware, and investigation is kind of soaking into the characteristics of that awareness. It's not conceptual. That's the thing that's really important to understand and hard to really get to the point of understanding it kind of operationally. That we want to be directly knowledgeable about the condition of the mind. What kind of stories are flowing or about to flow or have just flowed, and what kind of energy is flowing through the system? Is the selfing system really agitated or dull? Or is it balanced? Right? So that's what investigation of mental phenomena is about. So there's certain kinds of considerations. First of all, what's going on that's increasing suffering? How is that operating? Suffering in this context means there's tension in the body, a rigidity in the body, and the mind is kind of hooked. I talked last week, I think, about the there's a loop. It's called the thalamocortical loop. The thalamus is a part of the brain that's sort of like a transfer station. All kinds of stimulation comes in from other areas of the brain, gets processed in that part, and then goes back out to those areas of the brain. And it's called a thalamocortical loop. And noticing how there's an interaction between what the mind thinks and what goes on in the body, or conversely, what goes on in the body and what the mind thinks about it, observing that process and noticing whether that particular self state is creating a liberation or self state integration, or whether the mind is trapped by craving and clinging. Another thing that investigation provides, along with mindfulness, is a diminishment in reactivity, impulsive reactivity. I mentioned muscle tension. There's a very important nerve cluster that runs from the base of the brain down through the organs of the torso to the abdomen, and another part of it that goes back up. And that is the vagus nerve. And a lot of research has been done on the function of the vagus nerve, but also how that affects mood and how mindfulness benefits the functioning of the vagal process, right? So being able to investigate how tension is forming in the body. It might be located in your chest, or it might be in your fist or whatever. But to notice that and be mindful of it and investigate it, and then notice how that's correlated with what goes on in the mind that's making meaning and plans of action regarding that. And so there's a loop that's reverberating back and forth between body sensation and mind creation. So we can notice when that impulsive reactivity is diminished, when the tension in the body softens. How does that happen? What is that interaction in the dependent origination cycle? It's what's called nama rupa. Nama being what the mind creates, and rupa being sensations that are embodied sensations, hearing, seeing, so forth and so on. Noticing that interaction is what investigation of mental phenomena is about. How is it changing? Everything that we experience is transitory, but the mind gets trapped in loop and it seems as if it's solid and enduring. Where's the resistance? How can it be released? What's the preoccupation in the mind? How can that be dissolved? So, when we notice these characteristics and we can effectively regulate them, that brings into play the third awakening power, awakening factor, virya. Word virya is usually translated as strength or persistence. One of the classic references from early Buddhism is the power that it takes for a person to flex their arm, a strong person to flex their arm. I don't think of it that way. I think of it as energy. We are energy transforming organisms. We take in fuel, food, and oxygen, and it metabolizes into glucose and oxygen and travels throughout the circulatory system and provides nourishment or sustenance to muscles and so forth. Well, we're talking about here neural pathways, the brain. So there's energy channeling through the brain. And that energy is either moving toward binding the mind more and more into distress and confusion, self-state conflict, or alternatively, that energy is feeding neural pathways that are liberating the mind from various unwholesome self-states. And that's self-state integration. And then that process, when it reaches its fulfillment, leads to self-state liberation away from self-state integration. Okay. There's an important principle in the Noble Eightfold Path, right effort, and it's divided into four functions. And I'm just going to name them in any order. It doesn't mean any one of them is the first in line, so to speak. There's the noticing of an already arisen unwholesome mind state. Second one is the intention, the effort to disengage from that arisen unwholesome mind state. The third one is to notice the absence of an unarisen wholesome mind state and to foster its emergence. And the fourth one is the ability to sustain an already arisen wholesome self state to its fulfillment, its highest potential. Well, that fourth right effort is what I think the awakening factor of virya is. One of the ways I mentioned earlier that it is strength or persistence in terms of that term. So there's a persistent ability to disengage the mind from basically the five hindrances: sense, desire, aversion, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, or skeptical doubt, through mindfulness and investigation. So that process plays out, right? So that's what virya involves, is the ability to foster a consistent flow of wholesome neuronal connections. I mentioned neurons because, and I've talked about this before for some of you folks who are new. You know, when Buddhism was formed, the Buddha had to use the terms that were available in those days: understandings of nature and of politics and culture and so forth and so on. And every generation since then has had to readjust and readjust and readjust to make sense of what was brought up from the earlier generation into the current cultural mode, the current circumstances of life, right? And now we are here in the 21st century. And those of you who know me know I've been talking about the neuroscience associated with Buddhism for quite a while. I've been very interested in it from early on in my 40 plus years of practice. So in terms of this process of awakening, what we're observing with mindfulness, investigating and channeling the energy of this process, what we're observing is how the mind gets tangled in the hindrances. And through the right effort of letting go of unwholesome mind states, the mind becomes more and more coherent in its functioning, less and less internal conflict, more and more effective adaptive ability to adapt to changing circumstances. And that's what self-state integration involves, right? Life still has its challenges. People still make mistakes. But the ability to function on an ethically, a higher level of ethical behavior is enhanced. And the ability to negotiate your needs with the world is more adaptive, right? So that's how that works. Now, I'm going to move on to, first I'm going to talk a little bit about how these relate to the other awakening factors, and then dive again into describing how the transition occurs functionally from self-state integration towards self-state liberation, awakening, nirvana. Okay. So to be clear, sati stabilizes awareness. Dhammavicaya refines understanding. And virya sustains a wholesome engagement with what's going on. Minimal craving and clinging. As those are operating, they release the mind's functioning to the other factors. The other factors are the product, or the other factors functioning is increased in its potential for benefit. Joy, tranquility, concentration, equanimity. Those are all part of the human repertoire. We all have that capacity for that. Just like, we all have, most of us have the capacity for speaking. But some people with talent and training can sing. I'm not one of them. But anyway, what I'm saying is that the capacity to be joyful is hardwired into the human body. But usually our experience of joy is determined by external circumstances. Oh, this ice cream cone, it's a hot day, it's going to make me joyful. Or hearing someone tell a good joke, right? Those are external. This is not external, it's internal. So I'm just going to touch on these different factors because they're going to be amplified in discussion in the next couple of meetings. So because we have that innate capacity for joy, when the energy is bound up in desire or aversion, or the mind is too dull or too restless, or there's doubt and confusion, the energy that would be available for joy is instead in that loop, right? So when the mind is freed up from those preoccupations, the joy that's inherently available starts to emerge. And it's not like grinning from ear to ear. There's a sense of buoyancy, enthusiasm. I mean, I've talked so much about experiences of joy, but a person could be joyful even when situations are difficult because it's something that's generated from the freedom from the hindrances inside. The tranquility factor emerges because the mind is not restless. What happens with craving and clinging, the mind becomes jumbled up, excited. It's like what happens when water spills over a waterfall. It's all agitated. With tranquility, the mind becomes more peaceful. It flows nicely. But it's still flowing. It's not turbulent. I'm going to use another simile. I was at a retreat once, and the teacher said that she was at a retreat in Burma, and the retreat center was perched way up over the Irrawaddy River, which is a major transport link in that part of the world. And she would look down on it, and it seemed very still, like it was water retained by a dam. And then she would notice boats that did not have motors were traversing down the river very rapidly because there was a swift current. So even though the flow of water is not, there's not a lot of waves, there's still movement there. So that's what tranquility is. Tranquility is not dullness. And samadhi, the concentration factor, in this context, has to do with how well the other factors are interacting. It's more about unification, right? Stability is there, but also all the different functions are cooperating. And then upekkha, that functions in such a way that the mind is not reactive. Whatever comes up is observed with a quality of dispassion, viraga, is the Pali word. You just simply noted something that the brain has produced as being transitory and impersonal. So these are all useful in terms of overcoming or setting aside the hindrances. But the ultimate benefit comes from moving from self-state integration to self-state liberation. And that's what I'm going to talk about now. In terms of self-state conflict, my notes here have it as fragmented mind. These are the characteristics of it. This came from my use of ChatGPT. There's attentional instability. The mind kind of wanders without discipline. There's an emotional reactivity that's driving attention. There's a compulsive prediction. The mind starts to orient toward an expected outcome, a particular expected identity for oneself and for others. And this identity either needs to be defended or gratified. There's an ongoing threat monitoring. This is hardwired into the human body. Part of the brain that's always alert to potential threat or reward, but mostly organized around avoiding threat. And our hardwired tendency for desire for food, desire for sensual pleasure, desire for identity or status. So, the self-state conflict comes about because there are different sub-minds. There's a book that this community has studied a lot called The Mind Illuminated by a fellow named Chula Dasa, who was an accomplished meditator, but also an accomplished neuropsychologist. And talks about sub-minds. There's a visual sub-mind, an auditory sub-mind, olfactory, gustatory, somatosensory, and cognitive and affective. All of these are different areas of the brain. We call them sub-minds. And they are interacting in that loop process I mentioned about the thalamus. And that conflict comes about because there's not sufficient integration amongst those different sub-minds. But the awakening factors actually function to promote that kind of integration, synchronization of these different sub-minds. So, how does this operate? Well, first of all, mindfulness interrupts it. Mindfulness and investigation. They interrupt it. There's a noticing of how attention has shifted. One of the things that I'm working on personally is for some physiological reason, when I'm meditating, it's not uncommon for an itch to or originate right where the crease of my nose, my nostril is. Could happen on either side. Not inside, but on the outside, it starts to fire up with a burning sensation. And interestingly enough, the more I pay attention to it, the more vivid the sensation is, the more urgently reactive my mind is to it. Right? And I can scratch the itch and it works, but then it comes back again, either during that sitting later or on another sitting. I can work with that, interrupt it. Interrupt the mind's reactivity to it and open to it and let it be part of the whole picture of my being at that moment rather than the primary focus, primary and exclusive focus. So that's overcoming a hindrance. At the same time, it's starting to liberate the mind from a preoccupied self. What I mean by that is that there's a self that demands relief from this unpleasant itch sensation. Right? I can be aware of that self, the storyline, the urgency, and so forth and so on, and just let it be what it is without identifying with it. Right? So there's this curiosity about how this nama rupa mind body interaction is occurring as a process. The content would be that itch, but the process is noticing how the mind deals with that. And what facilitates that process is right effort, virya, the other awakening factor, the noticing the mind's preoccupation, letting it go, noticing being present with the discomfort in an objective way, letting that go. Just keep noticing and letting go, noticing, letting go, noticing, letting go. And this leads to self-state integration. So joy becomes more accessible, more evident, and it's just a sense of buoyancy or resilience in the face of adversity. Tranquility is there because, what, in my experience, what I do is, even though that itch is really strong, the urge is really strong, I open to the whole body vibe, so to speak. I've talked about this before. There's a sense of vibratory energy everywhere in the body, and that's a resource, right, for cultivating tranquility. When the mind is really caught with that urgent reaction to the itch sensation, there's tension. The tension is elsewhere in the body. Even something like blood pressure increases in the body. But releasing and relaxing, particularly on the out breath, opens that, softens that. So the body becomes very, very tranquil. And that nama rupa process enables the mind to be more tranquil. And that unifies all of these different functions, right? So that unification basically means that all these sub-minds are interacting in ways that are cooperative, mutually reinforcing, and kind of increases the signal strength that we could call the process of awakening, right? It becomes more clear how all of this works together, which is once again mindfulness and investigation and persistent right effort. So the mind is very open and peaceful and balanced, right? So that creates the circumstances that support to liberation. This requires a high degree of persistent investigation on a very subtle level. I've been talking with students lately about the importance of recognizing the illusory fabrication of self as an impersonal process, right? Being able to see through that. And that's what leads to the liberation, self-state liberation. Self-state liberation might mean nirvana, but for me, more importantly, it means that my mind is liberated from preoccupations, from worry, from greed, from anger. Just generally more peaceful, and life is more pleasant, the joy factor, right? That's the practice, and that's the self-state liberation. But self-state liberation really requires the self-state integration part. As long as the mind is caught up, with craving and clinging, preoccupied, it's not going to work. If all I can get is self-state integration, a peaceful, more wiser way of living. I'm certainly grateful for that. But then can be awakening. So here's what ChatGPT has to say about the maturation of these factors, and then we'll have time for discussion, questions, and comments. As this synthetic process, this cooperation between the factors matures, sati becomes effortless, non-forgetting of reality as a process, not a self, not a world. Dhammavichaya fully penetrates, revealing impermanence, the uncertainty and unsatisfactoriness of life, and the impersonality of the different characteristics, the functions of life. Virya transforms from striving into a steady non-collapse. Mind doesn't collapse into delusion. Sustained right effort. Piti is what joy is. It becomes quieter, less ecstatic, and more pervasive well-being. Pasadi, which is tranquility, deepens into profound non-agitation. Another river simile from Ajahn Chah, well-respected Thai master, talked to his students, and he asked them, "Have you ever seen a still river?" "Yes, master, we have." "Have you ever seen a moving river?" "Yes, master, we have." "Have you ever seen a still moving river?" And this goes back to the simile about the Irrawaddy, right? That's what we're talking about here. Still moving river. That's what upekkha is. Radical non-compulsiveness, not indifference, but freedom from forced positioning against experience. So what's the unconditioned mind? This once again from ChatGPT. The unconditioned does not mean a magical, eternal mental being or substance. It points to liberation from compulsive fabrication, grasping. Neuropsychologically, one might cautiously describe this as experience no longer organized primarily around defensive self-maintenance, greatly reduced prediction-driven appropriation, absence of compulsive identity construction, and minimal reification of mental events. Nervous system still functions, perception still occurs, personality still appears, but experience is no longer continuously contracted around, "This is happening to me." Mind ceases fighting reality to stabilize an imagined permanent controller. So I find this interaction, this intersection with ChatGPT to really stimulate my understanding. I've been studying these things for decades, and I have a pretty well-developed understanding of how the process works, but having ChatGPT giving me that feedback really, it got me excited today. So, questions or comments about the concepts of the seven awakening factors or how to recognize them and use them? Leslie.
Well, before you started tonight, I had a question about the function of the rising of the seven factors of awakening and the process, or yeah, I guess the process by which we cultivate these qualities. But I think you've answered that question to a great extent. by the way you talk have talked about mindfulness, first of all, the integration of all of them, but the importance of the first two, mindfulness and
Verse three.
investigation. Three. Well, I know you, I'm just thinking about mindfulness and investigation, but you're right, energy too. But so that's essentially the practice. I mean, that's that's the way we cultivate mindfulness, is by being mindful, by doing the practice, correct? And so I guess what my question is, are the other factors, joy, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity, are those results of
Yes.
those three? Ah, okay. Very helpful for me.
So
So,
let me review it again. When we practice mindfulness of breathing in its most basic form, aiming the attention at the beginning of the in-breath, sustaining attention for the duration of the in-breath. That's vitakka vichara, right? That is the initiation of mindfulness and investigation. And right effort. Because there's an intention to be consciously aware of the experience, the sensational experience of the in-breath and the out-breath. So the investigation of the sensation starts to build up into investigation of mental phenomena, Dhamma Vicaya. Now, there's energy there. Like I talked about, the glucose and oxygen is channeling into these neural pathways that are dedicated to aiming and sustaining. So there's a quality of persistence being trained for there. The mind jumps track because of craving and clinging, self-state conflict, right? Then when we aim and sustain at the breath, we're training the part of the brain to aim and sustain at any kind of deviation from that. That's actually a part of the brain that's called the salience network, that's alert for something new, right? And it starts to assess friend or foe, food or poison, right? So the process that's engaged in noticing the distraction, the characteristics of it, and then disengaging and going back to the breath involves mindfulness and the application of right effort. The effort to investigate and notice this is unwholesome, this distraction. The effort to re-engage with the breath, which is regarded as wholesome. And so that starts to build the first three factors. Now, as the mind becomes less and less vulnerable to being hooked by that thalamocortical cortical loop I mentioned, what the energy that would be bound up in the five hindrances is freed up. And that freedom manifests as joy. And this joy, depending on your references, the joy can be ecstatic. And I've experienced that before, but more effectively in terms of the awakening factor, it's engaged, curious interest, kind of buoyant curiosity that's joyful. What's going to happen next? What's going to happen next? What's going to happen next? And that combined with the ability to really work with the calming effect of breath awareness cultivates tranquility. The mind becomes more serene because it's less agitated by the hindrances. And then that stabilizes everything. That's the concentration factor, and it's balanced. The mind is not too agitated or tranquil. The mind is not too fixated or too distracted. It's in the sweet spot, right? So that's how they all work together.
That's so helpful. That is so helpful for me. And I also just want to say to everybody in the in the group. I've been hearing and reading and thinking about these concepts for 50 years, and I still learn each time I hear you talk. I'm learning more. So I have one more little question that sort of hinges on all of this. So we all know, we all have those moments. I've talked about this in group before, this experience that I had and was so delighted with not too long ago, of just walking down the street and was overcome by this sensation of joy. I was walking my dog. It was just an average Tuesday afternoon, but all of a sudden there was this definite, profound sense of easeful joy. So my question, and then I'll be quiet, but my question then is, it's not necessarily in the process of the mindfulness and investigation that these fa other factors arise, that they can just arise spontaneously in us, correct or not?
Well, they don't arise spontaneously. They arise because conditions are supportive. It might be that at that particular moment, the interaction amongst, mindful attention and investigative awareness and the absence of the burden of craving release the joy.
Okay.
But the more we train for it, it's sort of like we train for it formally, just in the same way that
Yes.
a musician trains is by playing the same chords over and over again on the guitar, so that when they go out, they can jam, right? So that's what we're doing with our practice. We try to notice these factors with as much clarity as possible, mindfulness and investigation and right effort being essential for that. And it starts to generalize out into life. Now, as you were talking, Leslie, when we were on retreat with Shyla Catherine at that retreat center here, you and I were walking
Yes,
and you were struggling,
I was.
but I was feeling joy. I might even have mentioned it to you during at the time. And not joy because you were struggling, but joy because my mind was just in the right place.
Yes.
I could still be empathetic and supportive and all that, but I did not feel heavy or worried or burdened by your
Yes.
skeptical doubts, what you were talking about.
I remember that exact conversation too, Peter. That's so cool.
So, Sharon here in the room has something.
Was talking about the concept of joy, and when you were talking about that, experiencing joy, I find that that comes up that at times when I'm just feeling relaxed, I'm feeling okay, it could be anywhere.
Right.
And it does, I think there is an inclination to feel joy. I have it. And I can be outdoors. I can, like, the sound of rain or, something that I'm just experiencing. I'm always aware of my surroundings. And that can bring joy. But this is the big concern that I have is that when I'm aware that I'm experiencing this joy, I want to grasp.
Right.
I want to cling. I want to hold on to it,
Right.
and that makes it go away.
Right.
So
That's right.
that's something that is I don't know
That's
what to.
the energy awakening factor that persists in
Yeah.
opening to joy without trying to control it.
So what do I do to not experience that and the awareness and oh my gosh, I'm grasping.
More practice is necessary. I mean, I'm saying that, those of you who don't know me, I say this on a regular basis. But the trajectory, the progression is that first it's, oh, it happened again, damn it. So more practice is necessary. But with joy, it happened again. Isn't that interesting?
Okay.
Right? So the more you train with regular meditation practice, the more clarity there is about recognizing those particular factors when they're in operation, right? My last 3 month retreat, I spent the first 6 weeks concentrating my mind. I spent the last 6 weeks contemplating the seven awakening factors. I would sit there for 2 hours. I usually sat for 2 hours at a time and just really try to be directly knowing, this is mindfulness. This is energy. This is joy. So I could recognize the characteristics. The more I did that, the more I've done that as a discipline, the more likely I am to notice it away from the practice. Additionally, one of the aspects of the Eightfold Path is right livelihood. And right livelihood basically means cultivating a lifestyle that is not burdened with unnecessary distress and confusion. We're all going to be exposed to distress and confusion, part of being alive. But, I've spent a lot of my life, half my life, trying to figure out how to live a life that does not require a lot of very stressful things. And I've been successful. I'm retired. Even in these days, I'm financially comfortable, I'm not rich, but I'm financially comfortable. But I think that's because of my practice. I've simplified my life, made different choices. So those are integrated. The practice supports the more integrated life. More integrated life motivates more practice. So more practice that's necessary becomes celebration rather than complaint.
But at that moment, and I appreciate your elaborating on it, but at that moment, the best that I can come up with is a smile. And I kind of
No, sure.
smile, and I think, there's Mara. There you are,
Hi, yeah. Hi, Mara. Welcome.
Yeah.
Come have a cup of tea.
Well, I don't get into that, but I smile and I say, oh, there it is, you know.
Right.
Anyway.
Right. And the trick is being able to recognize the difference between just a natural smile that comes out of the internal joy, or whether it's a grimace because I'm supposed to smile here. And sometimes being able to tell the difference is subtle and can flip from one to the other. But the idea is to be mindful of that. Now, I just realized I left something out. I mentioned the Noble Eightfold Path. One of the functions of the seven awakening factors is the transition or the maturation of the Eightfold Path into what's been called the Tenfold Path. And this is how that operates. Starts out with right effort, I mean, excuse me, right understanding, conceptual understanding of the Dharma, and right intention, which in this case is the intention to practice meditation, study and practice mindfulness meditation. And so the ability to function that way is brought to bear, so to speak, or brought to life with the application of what's called ethical concerns, right speech, right action, right livelihood. And that's what I was talking about in terms of lifestyle management. And honesty, and so forth and so on, reliability, authenticity. And then the third aggregate is right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So that's the discipline part, the training part. It's sort of like the tools are, right understanding, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood. But the skillful application of the tools is right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Okay, so that integrative process manifests ultimately the full realization of vitakka, vichara, and right effort matures into the seven awakening factors. And when awakening happens, right understanding becomes right knowledge. It's no longer conceptual. There's a direct realization of nirvana. And right intention becomes right release or right liberation, which means that the ultimate freedom from craving and clinging occurs in the Theravada tradition. Other Buddhist traditions have different ways of working with that. But I wanted to throw that in there. That's because in the Satipatthana Sutta, the end game is the realization, the fulfillment of the Noble Eightfold Path. Okay, we've run kind of long here, but are there any final questions before we close for the evening? Next week, Susan Baxter is going to be talking about the awakening factors of joy, tranquility. Not from the perspective that I'm providing, from her very own perspective, but it's a very rich field of inquiry and realization. So I'm very much looking forward to it. It's our custom at the end of each shared experience to sit together quietly for a brief interval. Let's do that. Thank you for your practice. I wish you well. I hope we're all reasonably safe and happy until the next time we have a chance to chat.
Thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you so much, Peter.
Bye, everyone.
Thank you, Peter. Bye-bye.
Bye.